Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. David Schaefer, co-founder and policy director at One Tent Health in Washington, D.C., about his work to establish free HIV testing confidentially in a tent, in a parking lot, with lots of volunteers. Pretty fascinating. Moreover, he is a new resident at Massachusetts General Hospital and did his training at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. A really homegrown success story of starting a nonprofit that's making a difference in people's lives. First, though, talking about research that matters. And first is an article out of the RAND Corporation. And this is about opioids and opioid overdose deaths, things from the painkillers and heroin and all sorts of deaths that actually kill more people now than most other things like car crashes or gun violence, even more than the HIV epidemic at its peak. So this is a major issue. And what they're looking at in this particular research study was what happens if you actually facilitate people getting naloxone, also called Narcan, the drug that can reverse people who've taken too much. A lot of people who take opioids, they may have taken too much. They may have injected too much. It could be their first experience. And it's really important for a loved one or a friend who perhaps knows that this is going on to be able to reverse it because the ambulances could get there too late. So if you can facilitate them getting this medication, a lot of times it would go through their doctor and having it on hand, but maybe not needing to do that. And so having it come directly from a pharmacist and even having facilitating pharmacists giving this naloxone. And they were really looking at this in this RAND study. What happened in states that adopted such laws? In 2014, 15 states gave pharmacists kind of an indirect authority to dispense this if they met certain criteria, if the people coming in were at high risk. And by 2016, 9 states allowed direct dispensing by the pharmacist. And what they found over 10 years from 2005 to 2016 is that opioid deaths fell 27% in the year after passage of these laws and 34% in following years. So this is pretty amazing, and it seems to be related. Now, this is not causal. You can't say that one caused the other. And certainly there could be lots of other issues at play here. They also found that visits to hospital emergency departments for non-fatal overdoses actually increased when these direct dispensing laws were passed. So you don't know if that because this was fewer patients were dying from the overdoses, so therefore they were showing up, or is it a, you know, another reason? I will say that these medications have predictable side effects, and there are side effects, and certainly the pharmacist, I'm certain, talks to the patients about those side effects. So this seems like something that's a win-win-win. It's a win for the healthcare system. It's certainly a win for the patients, and I think it's something that the pharmacist can get in patients' hands even better than perhaps the barriers that sometimes happen with the physicians. It doesn't take the place of, but it also could be helpful. Our next research that matters is about bullying. What an important issue. And this was to look at, is there really a difference in bullying for men and women and students, girls and boys, and the factors that can relate to it, and perhaps maybe missed opportunities. And what they basically found is that in some of the other research, there was no difference between the men and the women in terms of the students there, in terms of the bullying, in terms of there were different forms, but maybe not really equal rates here. The bullying that boys tend to have tends to be more often a kind of more violent there. And we do know that girls are often bullied more often than boys, and girls are often more likely to consider, plan, or attempt suicide compared with boys. So this was really kind of helping to understand these two things a little bit more. And what they basically found is that in a paper that was published in the journal Nursing Research, that the effects of bullying are significantly higher in females than males on every measure of psychological distress or suicidal thoughts and actions. And I think this is perhaps counterintuitive to people because they see that the physical bullying among boys and the school systems are really cracking down on that physical and that intimidation and can really have some major impact, but they're less likely to perhaps take seriously a lot of the psychological bullying that comes in more prevalent among females, such as the things that aren't as visible, excluding people from groups, relational, mocking them, social media activities, spreading rumors. And those types of bullying seem to have a significant, even greater impact than the bullying on the boys, which is then on the psychological distress and suicidal thoughts. It's not an either or, no doubt about that. I do think it helps us as parents, as providers, as school administrators, perhaps even the justice system, to better understand what are our responsibilities in each of us in order to make an impact on this bullying in society. Our next research that matters is about kids with chronic illness. And I imagine that if you were to take families and maybe even extended families, you would find that pretty much all extended families would have a kid with a chronic illness, things like asthma or eczema, a skin condition, or diabetes or obesity or so many things. And the question that these researchers were really interested in is, does this really diminish children's happiness? And I think you could see on one level that'd be really easy. If you had one of these inflammatory, kind of real reactive guts that causes you to sometimes bleed and have diarrhea, you could say, yeah, that could make you pretty miserable. If you have diabetes and you got to inject yourself all the time, that can make you pretty miserable. And we would spend a lot of time really working with the kids to try to mitigate, to lessen those chances, and working with the families to kind of make sure that the environment makes these kids happy. And that would make sense and it would be a good thing. But in research in the journal Pediatrics, when these researchers interviewed over 1,200 U.S. children, they actually found that regardless of whether these kids had one or more chronic illnesses, what really mattered as to whether or not they were adjusting really well came down to two more things like social determinants of health, not the health condition itself. And that was whether the family had a solid, good income. That's a great thing that tells you how much income can relate to basic minimums of keeping kids fed and happy and busy, and then how much stress they had. So if the family had a lot of stress, then this clearly was counteractive on the children, regardless of the numbers of chronic illness. So I think, you know, we do understand that chronic illness is serious among children, and we must do everything we can to mitigate it. But we also must understand that just alleviating stress within families and providing for good jobs may be just as, if not more, important. Our last research that matters is something that I guess is personal to me and maybe every physician in the United States: tracking whether or not we're good physicians. And this is looking at, there's a U.S. website done by Medicare called Physician Compare that's designed to allow the public to see, you know, if I were new in a community and I wanted to pick a good doctor, who should I go to? And that sounds easier than it is. And so there's right now 1 million doctors that care for Medicare enrollees, but only 1 in 5 has actually any quality information on this site. This was actually research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal, Internal Medicine. And even of those 1 in 5 that have any quality information, none of it's actually tied to their job performance. So you really can't say, this is a good doctor or a bad doctor. And I'm not even sure that's the right question. We have to believe that doctors are trained. And, you know, I do think asking your friends who do they go to and what their impressions are, that's probably a very sensitive indicator. Certainly, we'd like to know, you know, does the doctor take time? Do they read? Are they experienced? Do they have quality metrics about diagnosing their patient's diabetes and getting them on the right medications. The quality metrics we have right now, unfortunately, I don't think tell you whether or not they're a good doctor. They could tell you whether they can punch boxes and hit some of these quality metrics, but I don't know if that means they're a good doctor even. Got a long way to go. Someone got a good business idea? Well, we're going to actually be able to talk with someone who had a good business idea and actually implement it after a break. That'll conclude the research that matters. When we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. David Schaefer, co-founder and policy director at One Tent Health, about what he and his colleagues are doing to really make a difference and save lives for people with HIV. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, we have an interesting guest and an opportunity to talk about something that's a little different and very important. We're talking with Dr. David Schaefer, co-founder and policy director at One Tent Health, and also an emergency medicine resident at Massachusetts General Hospital, about literally a tent, a parking lot, and a group of devoted people who are trying to save lives. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Schaefer.
Thank you so much for having me, Adam.
You know, I think it's an interesting combination of lots of things that will hopefully stimulate conversations today. And one of the ones I'm first wanting to hear a little bit more about is, I know because you were at the University of North Carolina for medical school that we know of you from medical school, but tell us a little bit about your path. How did you get interested in medicine? How'd you end up at North Carolina? And then how'd you end up at Mass General?
Sure. So I'm originally from Boone, North Carolina, over near Tennessee. In terms of how I got interested in medicine, it really happened in college. I had just finished shadowing my stepmother, who is an emergency room nurse in North Carolina, and was just fascinated. And when I was at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., I had a chance to get a little more exposure to some different types of medicine and loved the science behind it, and started learning more about global health and chose to study that in college. Started getting some experience with the different specialties, and then realized I really liked the people aspect of medicine rather than just doing science research. And that's how I ended up going into medicine. And then it was a pretty easy pick for me to come back to North Carolina for medical school.
Well, we're really glad you did. And how did you end up going into emergency medicine?
It is interesting. I think emergency medicine was one of my first interests, like I mentioned, after doing some shadowing. And I think I mostly liked the diversity of it. I would say, you know, maybe with the exception of family medicine, there's not a lot of specialties where you get such a breadth of pathologies and of people that come through the door. And I loved that because, you know, you never get bored in the emergency department. And you get a chance to be sort of an advocate on a lot of different topics, ranging from gun violence to some of the stuff that I do with HIV work. And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in what is a relatively young specialty compared to some of the others. So I think that's probably what drew me to it.
Well, let me just ask you, you founded this nonprofit called One Tent Health. Tell us the story of how you came to co-found this organization.
So it really, I have to trace it back to when I was at Georgetown University and taking a class with a friend of mine who is the co-founder and CEO. His name's Mackenzie Copley. And I remember the professor, she put a piece of paper on the desk, one in front of each student, that showed the HIV rate in the District of Columbia was as high or higher than many areas of sub-Saharan Africa at the time, which absolutely blew us away. We're living in the D.C. area, you know, in the district, and for several years and had no idea that it was this much of a problem. And Mackenzie started doing some volunteering and started doing HIV testing and found that this company he was working with was turning people away. if they were uninsured. And that really bothered him because, as you could imagine, some of the people who really need access to care don't always have insurance. And I did an experiment myself on a Tuesday afternoon, tried to figure out how long it would take me to get an HIV screen in D.C., and I couldn't get one. It took me several hours, and I couldn't find the right place, and then someone wasn't available. And we were just sort of amazed that there could be such a big problem, and there wasn't an easier way to do this. And so we had this idea of getting a 10 by 10 foot canvas tent like you might see at a high school cross-country meet. And we said, let's get out in the nooks and crannies of the city. We don't need to be on college campuses or at health fairs, but let's be outside of laundromats, outside of grocery stores, outside of pharmacies. Let's meet people where they are, and let's get them screened in a way that's fast and that is free. Our first screening event was in October of 2017, but there were several years between when we first had this idea and getting licensing and learning about the testing kits and what was required to do it. And one of the things we realized is that, you know, in the 1990s, maybe to do an HIV screen, you might need a trained laboratory technician. You would need a big van that might cost $50,000. It would take, you know, maybe 20 minutes or an hour to run the test. But in 2019 now, our tests run in 60 seconds. And they can be done by an undergraduate volunteer, and that's where most of our volunteers come from, is the universities in the area, who go through about 6 to 10 hours of training. And we've been able to get people screened for HIV and get other prevention resources to them in 10 to 15 minutes, totally free, in and out really quickly, and it's been a really great project so far.
Oh, that's a remarkable step and progress to take while you're really going in through through medical school, starting a nonprofit in a community. So, David, let me ask you, you're really coming across this need. Tell us about who comes in and where do you set up these tents?
So when we originally thought about setting up tents outside of grocery stores, some of us were pretty skeptical. We wondered if people walking by and seeing a tent for HIV screening, which can, of course, be a more sensitive topic, would be willing to stop before getting groceries to get an HIV screen. And so our first screening event was in October 2017 outside of a grocery store in D.C., and we immediately had a line of people. And to say, who are these people, it's hard to answer because we had such a range. We had people as young as 18 and as old as people in their 70s. We had couples come in and tell us what a great thing it was we were doing, because what we realized is that a lot of members of the D.C. community, particularly in the areas that are most affected by HIV, are actually fairly aware of the problem that's been going on in D.C. since the 80s. And there was not a lot of resistance. We had a generally very warm reception. We've even had parents tell us how glad they are that, you know, their 18-year-old son or daughter could stop in while they were getting groceries to get this done. Overall, we've been really, honestly, I was almost surprised at first, but really pleased with the reception we've had by the community.
And how did you pay for these testing?
So the actual kits themselves, the testing kits, are provided by the D.C. Department of Health. So that's been a huge component of where we get the funds for this. A big part of what we try to do and part of our mission is to just minimize the complexity. And part of that is staying very lean and not doing things that we don't absolutely need to do. But we've been very fortunate. We've had grants from AIDS United, from Gilead, and several others that are escaping me at the moment. But over the past few years, we've been very fortunate, as well as some individual donors who've helped sort of keep us afloat. But we have, you know, a team that works on grants constantly, and you know, we don't charge anyone to anything to get a screen, and we never will.
I imagine some people can pay for it, and many cannot pay for it. And I would hope that those who can pay for it would say, well, I would be happy to do this, particularly because it would maybe help someone else who can't pay for it.
Sure. And I think what I would say to that is, how do you determine who can or can't pay for it? And I think it's a little bit tricky to rely on any single measure of, well, you know, who can pay for this and who can't. And then if we get into billing insurance, you slow down the process and can't move people through the screening as quickly. So I think we would probably say to someone who says, well, I can pay for this, I would say, well, please donate then.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you want to pay for the cost of your screen.
Absolutely. And we're going to, before we finish today, we're going to make sure we have a link so that if people do want to donate, they certainly can. But we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. David Schaefer, co-founder and policy director at One Tent Health, about how one takes a parking lot and a group of devoted people to try to save lives from HIV. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. We've been talking with Dr. David Schaefer, co-founder and policy director at One Tent Health, as well as an emergency medicine resident at Massachusetts General Hospital, about his work and his co-founder's work to establish an organization to do HIV testing by setting up testing in a parking lot with volunteers. Tell us about maybe a couple stories of what happens when people have gotten a diagnosis, sometimes what they were expecting, maybe sometimes what they weren't expecting.
So what I can tell you about the diagnosis piece is that these are screening kits, first of all, and so we try not to use the word diagnosis, but they are quite accurate. And so when someone does test positive, we can be fairly certain, unfortunately, that they do have HIV. And one of the most important pieces is linkage to care, because One Tent Health is all about screening and about prevention, but we don't have doctors on site there to treat patients. And it's really important to get those people into care as soon as possible. And one of the common themes I've seen on site and that I've heard from our volunteers is that people worry about cost. Once they hear about this diagnosis and we're able to explain that nowadays this is a very treatable, though not curable, disease, that people are living long lives with HIV, they're worried about how are they going to find a doctor to take care of them and how are they going to afford this if they don't have insurance. And so one of the ideas we had was to have someone go directly with the patient to their first appointment, which is usually the same day. So we were able to partner with clinics in D.C., and we have these undergraduate volunteers who have been trained on what questions to ask and how to get people linked into care. We actually have them go directly same day to see a doctor and to sort through all those problems, to get them signed up for DC Medicaid if they don't already have it. And, you know, I've been on the phone with people who have been diagnosed afterwards and talked about the experience and how grateful they were, because as scary as this can be, it would be much worse to not know that you have HIV, which is unfortunately the case for about 15% of people in the United States who currently have HIV. They do not know their status.
And getting a negative diagnosis is probably incredibly reassuring, feeling quite good for those who maybe were worried.
Absolutely. Some want to measure success by number of new positive cases, which certainly is an important thing that we track, but there is a lot of value in getting a negative result and being able to tell your partner that you had a negative result and encouraging that person to go and get an HIV or other STI testing. So there is absolutely value both from a medical perspective, but from a psychological perspective, getting that negative test.
You know, it's interesting. You start off by saying how you tried to get it yourself. And I imagine you could have gone to your primary care provider if you had one, but that might take time. You might not be able to get in quickly. You could have gone to the health department, but that might have lots of different barriers and location and driving. You could have gotten a home testing kit, right? There is a home testing kit available.
There are home testing kits. I don't know a ton about costs exactly, and I think you can even order them online, but I can't imagine that they're free.
No, they're probably $35, which is not huge, but it's right. Maybe a barrier to lots of people getting tested.
Certainly. And the barriers are everywhere, and they're of all types. If you can imagine that some of our clients maybe work two jobs and they don't have time to make an appointment with a provider and go, you know, wait in a waiting room and have their vitals taken and have their weight and height taken. And as helpful as all that is and as critical as all that is for other health maintenance activities, if you are planning an hour to go get groceries, most people could spend an extra 10 minutes at the end of the day to get the HIV screening done, and then eliminating the cost from that too, while also being very visible and being out in the community. These are all ways that we're trying to break down the barriers and increase access.
Tell us just a bit about, it's very sensitive because you have to be able to talk about and ask about things like intercourse or oral sex or other sorts of behaviors that perhaps are foreign to those that are doing the training. How do you do the training?
That's a great question. One of the challenges that we initially faced was that we were going to have people who are not trained healthcare professionals out on site discussing these sort of sensitive topics and answering questions. And how do we get them trained up to do this without creating a burden or a barrier to entry to where it required so much training that no one would want to volunteer with us? So we reached out to CDC and used a couple of the training modules that they've created over the years, and we're constantly working to improve them. We worked with AIDS United to do a little bit of cultural sensitivity training. We have worked with the National LGBT Health Education Center here in Boston, who has created a great module on this stuff to try to adapt it to the kind of work we're doing. But then you can't just do online modules and these kinds of things and PowerPoints. You've got to get people in person, get them into small groups, and get them talking about the issues and seeing the kinds of questions that come up. So we do in-person training, learning the mechanics of it, learning how to do the tests, but also learning the kinds of questions that people ask. You know, we have people say, well, could I get HIV from a public toilet seat? Can I get it from kissing someone? Could I get it from touching someone's skin or blood? You know, we have to be able to answer all of these kinds of questions.
As you're kind of looking forward, you've been doing this now for a couple of years. Have you been able to set up tent pop-ups in other cities, and or are you considering other things you may diagnose? For instance, getting a pregnancy test, relatively straightforward testing.
So in terms of other cities, what I can tell you is we've been in touch with health departments in several other cities who have reached out to us and been interested in having us expand into their area, and we're definitely interested in doing that. This time last year, I think we had about 200 volunteers, and today we have over 1,000 volunteers, and we've screened hundreds of people, and we'd like for that to grow. And so while we haven't committed to a specific next area just yet, we are absolutely working on growing and giving more people the opportunity to be out volunteering and working on this. And I think it's a matter of figuring out what exactly our strengths are as an organization and what our abilities are that other brick and mortar facilities might not have, and figuring out how to capitalize on that. So I can tell you I've looked into thinking about the opioid epidemics and if there's a role that one tent might be able to play. I've thought about hepatitis C screening. And so I think it's just a matter of understanding the technologies, what's being done, and having to really be up to date on the latest research on this kind of community-based screening. But I can tell you we're certainly not opposed to expanding the services.
So listeners, they don't have access if they don't live in Washington. What is your advice to those people? And what's the take-home lesson you're taking forward with you now in your training, perhaps to all of the other residents and doctors you're training with?
Sure. What I could say is this, is that it may feel like there's not an easy way to get one of these tests done. But in general, there are a lot of programs out there that want to make this accessible. And whether or not it is as easy as they'd like, there should be a way to get it done for free, whether that's at the health department or if you have insurance, it should be covered at your primary care provider. Emergency departments will do it if you're particularly concerned. But the other thing I would say is that if you're, you know, in a certain group that is of particularly high risk, In general, men who have sex with other men without condoms, or if you use IV drugs and other risk factors, you could talk about a prescription for PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is a medication that can actually prevent HIV with quite impressive effectiveness. You could talk with your doctor about that. And then in terms of what I've learned from it and what I would say for other people who are interested in this kind of stuff and maybe other physicians or residents is that compared to maybe other startups and healthcare startups where there's so much competition and very cutthroat, we've experienced nothing but cooperation, people just trying to work together on a common problem. And I don't know if that is specific to the HIV and AIDS epidemic or if it's part of being a nonprofit and working with the Department of Health. But in general, we found that if you're working on a problem like this, people want to help you, not hurt you. And so I would say, reach out to others who are doing this. If you're listening and you're interested in the HIV epidemic or innovative solutions and want to talk, I love talking with people about this kind of stuff and would love to hear from you.
Well, we certainly appreciate your hopeful as well as can do, roll up the sleeve, get in the parking lot approach to bring people together. And I will say we're also proud of you as a Carolina alumnus for this work and giving us all a challenge. We're going to put up a link to your nonprofit for those who might like to donate, and we would encourage that.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, we want to thank you for being our great guest today. We've been talking with Dr. David Schaefer, co-founder of One Tent Health, about their work really trying to save lives. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about your health questions and concerns. If any listener wants to send us a question or concern, you can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
So our first listener says, I'm in my mid-70s, and I've noticed over the last 3 months that I have increasing amounts of left shoulder, arm, and hand pain with some numbness in my left hand. My doctor said this could be coming from my neck, but I don't have any neck pain, really. Why did she do neck x-rays?
Well, your doctor probably had a good sense that pain that's radiating down the entire arm and giving you some numbness in the hand is probably coming from above the arm. And the most likely place would be something that's impinging on the nerves of the neck as they're coming out on that left side. We would see cervical arthritis or degenerative arthritis, osteoarthritis, all the same types of arthritis of the
arthritis.
Kind of the neck area. It can also be in the shoulder. You could also have it in the hand.
Okay.
It could be the elbow. I mean, it could really be any of those things. But to all of a sudden be happening in all of them and having numbness in your hand, arthritis in the fingers doesn't really give you numbness per se. Arthritis in the shoulder doesn't give you numbness, but it gives you pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think your doctor's trying to figure it out. I would hope they also did x-rays of at least your shoulder and maybe your hands to take a look at these things. There are other conditions that could cause that impingement that aren't necessarily arthritis related. So that has to be in the back of their mind too, things like cancers or tumors, but unlikely because arthritis of the neck is really common.
And does neck pain ever come with that kind of diagnosis or?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, if you take a really good enough history and you start palpating back on the neck, they go, ow. You know, it's like, is that part really tender there? It's like they call it their shoulder, but they're feeling in the base of their neck.
Oh, I see.
You know, and you have you know, these six cervical kind of vertebras and where these bones in the back of the neck and the nerves that are exiting them. So depending on where that nerve exits is where that pain radiates to. The good news is, regardless of it, you got to make a diagnosis, get the right treatment.
Yeah.
Good luck. Thanks for that question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've heard of the medication methadone being used to help people get off long-term heroin use. More recently, however, my doctor said it could be a medication for me to use instead of opiates for my chronic pain. Is this really something I should consider?
Well, you know, methadone is a really interesting medication, and I think it's one that most people probably haven't really thought about. we know it really as methadone. We don't really know it by any brand names of what it's called. And it actually can counteract some of the, you know, the pleasure centers one would get from heroin. And so from that aspect, it's used in detoxification protocols, not really detoxification, but substitute protocols, so methadone replacement in the community. However, most primary care doctors actually can't prescribe methadone for that reason. You have to get it from someone who's specifically licensed to give methadone instead of heroin. And it can be a substitute that can be safer and really be life-saving. But it's also an opioid so that it can actually be pain responsive. So you can use it for people for pain. And one thing good about methadone, just like opioids, is you can start low and go slow and then kind of titrate it up for that. And, you know, people can see if and when they get response. And you can be on chronic methadone just like you're on chronic pain medications. But you also have to take drug tests, right? Make sure you're not taking other drugs. You're not diverting it. You're not selling it. You're not abusing it. But it's certainly for some people, let's say, get really nauseous on the non-methadone opiates. It may be helpful. If they have other side effects, it could be helpful. You certainly have to really follow things carefully, things like make sure you don't have cardiac side effects. So again, you need to have a doctor that's familiar with this medication, familiar with these potential side effects, but it's a possibility.
Interesting.
Had you ever heard of it for pain?
No.
Yeah, I'd suggest most patients have not, and actually probably most providers don't as well because it's not used as much. And I think in general, we're trying to cut down on all pain medications, and I think that's good. What's our very last house call?
I have a problem, and I'm not sure if I should see my doctor. There's this swelling on the left side of my neck that comes and goes, and it's been happening for several weeks. When my neck swells, it's painful, but then it does go away. Do you think this could be something serious?
Well, I think some of my colleagues would say that the pain in the neck is sometimes me encouraging them to, you know, not that type of pain. No, not that. Good question, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly in today's time when we're trying to say, well, maybe we can not come into the doctor. We can do advice over the phone, right? And save everyone time, expense, those kinds of things. I don't know. What are you thinking? How would you be thinking about this, Laura, when, you know, as a patient, if you're, you know, having this come and go several times, you're worried, right?
Well, I do. I actually, I have personally thyroid nodules, and the way we had those diagnosed is because I had intense swelling at the base of my neck. And I remember kind of just writing it off for a little bit, just thinking it was sort of like a swollen gland or something. But then when I finally went to the doctor, I was like, oh, this is actually something else that we need to monitor a little bit. So,
right. So you're more attuned now,
yeah.
But you also felt maybe you should get it evaluated. You're worried about something, Joe.
Yeah.
I'm not saying most patients are worried when you get a swelling in your neck. Is it cancer? Let's
yeah.
just call it what
sure.
it is. Cancers don't usually come and go. So it probably isn't cancer, but you know what? It could be an infection. It could be virus or bacterial. It could be something, probably not, but things like the Epstein-Barr virus are also known as infectious mono.
Okay.
But probably not. And so I can't really tell you, though, without actually seeing it, and particularly when it's swollen. It won't probably be helpful when it's not swollen to see it as much. But I think if it's coming and going, it'd be worth a visit.
And if it's painful, and I'm sure the swelling's uncomfortable, I mean, you don't want it to keep coming and going indefinitely.
Inflammation of the lymph nodes, which is what the doctor would be thinking about, would be most frequent. But, you know, if you smoke cigarettes, if you drink alcohol, these things may raise risk factors. It gets you a little worried. So let me do the worrying for you.
Nice.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. David Schaefer. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.